Today we'll deal a bit with the idea of bargaining with terrorists and what type of concessions you can make in hostage situations, etc. And also how we derive this from the Talmud. You know, you have the classic, the unfortunately classic scenario of terrorists who hijack a plane, and they take the hostages, and either they'll ask for money, or they will ask for some of their fellow terrorists to be released from prison in wherever it is, Israel or Kuwait. And the official stance of the Israeli government is not to negotiate at all. And they basically give two reasons for that. Number one is that agreeing to any demands creates a precedent and will encourage further hijackings. Number two is the terrorists who they do set free will now be a danger to society again, and they'll be free to kill and create more havoc. Now, what we want to know is this approach halakhically justifiable? Is this correct according to Jewish law? What does Jewish law, if anything, say about this? So we have a source for this situation, in the Mishnah in Gittin, 45a. Mishnah in Gittin, Memhei, speaks about here the obligations of a husband to the wife and to various relatives in terms of redeeming them from captivity. Certain obligations specified between husband and wife and various members of the family in terms of redeeming from captivity. And here the Talmud talks about, in general, the mitzvah of redeeming someone from captivity, which says is one of the highest and greatest mitzvahs associated with tzedakah, with charity. Excuse me. That you can do. It says you're allowed to sell the Sefer Torah to redeem someone from captivity, even if their life is not in danger. But nevertheless, redeeming someone from captivity is a very, very great commandment. The Mishnah says, despite all this, despite the fact that it is such a great commandment, the Mishnah says, "Ein podin es ashvim yeser al kadei demehem." One does not redeem captives more than they are worth. Mipnei tikkun ha'olam, as a decree for the betterment of the world, society. Now, what do we mean more than they're worth? Well, the scenario that we're talking about here in the times of the Talmud is a time that there was a slave trade existing, which means every person had a particular value on the market to be sold as a slave. So, when someone was captured by this gang of brigands, etc., and they would hold him up as a hostage, and they'd say, "Give us so and so amount of money, or we'll sell him as a slave." The amount that they would demand is about the amount that they get from him as a slave. Which means that you should not give more than the amount that the person gets on the slave market for his value. So now the reason the Mishnah says is mipnei tikkun ha'olam, for the betterment of society. Now here we have a question. What do we mean? The Gemara asks, Talmud comes along and asks, what do we mean for the betterment of society? What reason are you? What possible reason could you have for not redeeming them more than they're worth? And the Gemara gives a number of reasons. Any suggestions? Why are we not allowed to redeem a captive for more than his value? Is this good advice or is this a prohibition? Another question has to be clarified. Is the Mishnah saying, look, don't do it because it's not good for you? Or is the Mishnah giving an actual prohibition? So really this depends on the reason. One reason advanced in the Talmud is Mishum Duchka de Tzibura, because this will impoverish the community if you are continuously giving in to demands of various groups for money by capturing members of the community, and you give in by giving more than the value, exorbitant ransoms. In such a situation, the community will become impoverished. So we say, no, don't redeem them for more than their value. The other reason given in the Gemara is Mishum Delol Ligrivu Velesu Tvei, in order not to encourage them to do this more. If they see that they can get more than the market value, this will encourage them to do this more. So now, there are a number of differences between the two reasons. If we say that the reason is for the impoverishment of society, Let me ask, what about a situation where the life of the hostage is being threatened? Our Mishnah is talking about a case where the life of the hostage is not necessarily being threatened. So in such a situation, he'll be sold into slavery, but then the community won't be impoverished. What would be, though, if his life was in danger? Should we say, well, maybe the community should become impoverished to save the guy's life? So here, many authorities say, yes, if the reason that you're not allowed to give more than the actual value is so as the society should not, the community should not become impoverished, but if the person's life is in danger, you may give even more than the value. You should give even more than the value, because his life is worth more than your money. If the reason is, so as not to encourage this practice, if the reason that we would conclude is that you're not allowed to pay more than their value so as not to encourage a practice, then if they put the hostage's life in danger, this reason would still apply, according to many authorities. Why? Because what you're going to be doing is, if you accede to this demand, you're just going to be putting other people's lives in danger. The terrorists, the kidnappers, are going to continue doing this.
But then it's no longer a monetary concession.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. But if we're going to give a monetary concession to these people because someone's life is in danger, then all we're going to do is encourage them to put more people's lives in danger. So here we say, better that this person's life be in danger than to expose all of society to greater dangers. Right. So here it's a hard prohibition to keep, but what it's saying is, don't accede to their demands more than the normal market price, so to speak, is what the Mishnah is saying. There are other differences between the various reasons it will give. There are other differences also. For instance, supposing you have a person who's a millionaire. He's not going to ask around for money for the rest of society, the rest of the community, to ransom the captive. All he's going to do is pay out of his own bank account. So here we'd have a difference. If the reason that you're not allowed to redeem the captives for more than their value is so the community does not become impoverished, this guy's got a relative who's been captured, been kidnapped, and he's got money. No one's going to become impoverished. He's not going to become impoverished even if he pays an exorbitant ransom. So if we say the reason is the impoverishment of society, he would be allowed to pay more than the value. Why? Because the community is not going to become impoverished. If we say, however, that the reason is so as not to encourage this practice on part of the kidnappers, then even if this guy is going to pay for it out of his own pocket and no one else is going to become impoverished, nevertheless we'd tell him, sorry, you cannot give in to their demands because you're going to endanger the rest of us. You've got to encourage this practice. So we have a very important, it's very important to clarify then, in the final halacha and final decision in Jewish law, we have to clarify which reason applies. There's another dispute. Tosfot says, this is not accepted, but Tosfot says that the reason of encouragement does not apply in times of exile. In nowadays, Tosfot says. Nowadays, the Tosfot was 12th century France, but unfortunately still applies nowadays, which is, he says, if the reason is impoverishment of society, then yes, it does apply. This ruling does apply. If the reason is so as not to encourage people to attack the Jews in this way, he says the reason doesn't apply. Why? He says they don't need any encouragement. Anti-Semitism is such that they'll do this, whatever, that we'll be attacked in this way, whatever we do. We're in a no-win situation. So he says even if we do give in to demands, it won't encourage them more than have we not given in to demands. That's what Tosfos says. That would be also another difference in terms of how we decide when we come to the reason for that particular decree. Okay, so we have three differences between the two, three differences between the two reasons. One is when there's danger to life. If the reason is impoverishment, then it does not apply and you could redeem for more than the value. If the reason is not to encourage further kidnapping of this sort, then the prohibition does apply and you could not redeem. Second, we'll be in a situation where it's one individual who is going to pay and not the whole community, then the reason of impoverishment of the community would not apply. On the other hand, the reason that not to encourage this would apply. And then Tosfot, who says that if they don't require any further, this is Tosfot in 54a in Gittin, that the anti-Semites don't require any further encouragement. So if the reason is impoverishment, that would still apply, the prohibition would still apply, but if the reason is so as not to encourage them, that wouldn't apply. Just three differences. So what we do is we'll look in Maimonides and the Code of Jewish Law to see how they basically decide what reasoning they bring as the final authoritative opinion. So if we look in the Code of Jewish Law and Maimonides, what we'll find is that they mention both reasons. Both reasons. Now, if they mention both reasons, that means all the limitations are going to apply, which means this, that even if many authorities mention that according to the Maimonides and the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law, who bring as the main reason, the main reason they bring is so as not to encourage further acts of terrorism. Maimonides and the Code of Jewish Law both bring as the main reason not to encourage further acts of terrorism, which means this, that even if there is danger to the life of the captive, according to Maimonides and the Code of Jewish Law, it would be forbidden. This is a matter of dispute, but many authorities maintain that if there is danger to the life of the captive, it would be forbidden to redeem them for more than their value, for exorbitant amounts, because this will encourage further acts of terrorism of the same type. Put further people into danger and endanger the whole of society. So even though the captive's life is in danger, they would say, no, do not accede to exorbitant demands. Exactly what is an exorbitant demand, we'll have to determine later. But basically they say you would not be able to give in. In addition, they say, even if there's an individual who's willing to pay for the whole amount himself, according to Maimonides and the Code of Jewish Law, you should not give in to the demands. Here, however, many authorities are lenient that if one person is willing to pay for it himself and the hostage's life is in danger, if you have both of those mitigating circumstances, number one, the hostage's life is in danger and the entire burden for the payment will be on one person, then many authorities say that he can redeem them in that case. There's another exception to the rule. There's another place where the rabbis did not decree that there is a limitation, and that is where the person himself or his wife is in danger, or herself and her husband. In such a situation, the rabbis did not impose a limitation, Tosfot says. They said, you can pay whatever you want. We're not going to give you a limitation. Why? The reason is very simple. They're not going to impose a limitation which goes against the human instinct. The person will pay whatever. The person will not listen to such a decree. To tell the person you must sacrifice yourself rather than pay out money, the person will not do. Right? So they would be imposing a useless decree by saying no, don't pay out even if your own life or your wife's life is in danger. Why the spouse? Because the spouse and the person because spouses are considered one unity, one entity in Jewish law. The man and the woman are considered as one being. But in any case, Tosfot mentions this as another exception to the rule. So one exception to the rule as final halakha, even if we decide that it's so as not to encourage this, is in the case where the hostage's life is in danger, plus one person in the community is willing to take the entire burden upon themselves. The other exception, is where it's yourself in danger. Then the rabbis impose no limitation on you because it would be useless. Now, what do we call more than their market value? How do you determine that? So, in the times of the Mishnah and the Gemara, and for unfortunately a long time after, there was the situation where there was slavery. People were sold on the market. Very easy to determine. You work out what the person's market value is. If they're being sold for, the person's being sold for manual labor. So Woody Allen would fetch maybe $10. And Arnold Schwarzenegger would probably get $2,000 or something like that. If they're being sold for writing comedy, then it would be the reverse. Some would argue with that. But in any case, it was very easy to determine the value in such a situation. What about in the absence of a slave market? How do you determine what's exorbitant, what's an exorbitant value for to pay as ransom for the kidnapped victim? So Maram Lublin, in a responsa in 50, says, even though there's no slave trade, the only way you can work out the criteria is by trying to work out what would the person's value be if there would be a slave trade. But how do you work that? You've got to work out what would the person pay, let's say, for 20 years of Arnold's labour. Right? You've got to have Arnold Schwarzenegger working in your quarry for 20 years. So what's the going value for something like that? So you can work out whatever, the quarry worker gets $15,000 a year, and so for continuous work for 20 years, you multiply 15,000 by 20, whatever it would be, but he says you'd have to work out economically what people would be willing to pay for that, and that's the only criteria you have. This is hotly disputed. The Radvaz, or David Ben Zimri, an authority who lived in Egypt in about the 16th century, maintains that the way you'd work it out is only through common practice. What is common practice in general non-Jewish society? What is normal price for a ransom, for a captive, for a ransom, to ransom a kidnapping victim? And he says then the Jew would not be allowed to exceed that. In other words, because if the Jew does exceed that, then that, what's that going to do? That's going to encourage attack upon the Jews. That's what we don't want to do, right? We don't want to encourage attacks upon the Jews. So if people see, oh, Jews are willing to pay twice the price of everyone else, so let's kidnap Jews. Let's attack the Jews more. Let's attack an Israeli plane. Of course, they don't encourage them to do that, which we'll discuss later. But if the motive is financial, then the Radvaz says a very logical idea, which is, if the motive is financial, you've got to work out what the generally going price is, what people do pay for ransoms. You are not allowed to exceed what that general price is for a ransom. Of course, this becomes this is difficult to do even when they're only asking for money, but it could be done both according to the criteria of the Maram Lublin and the criteria of the Radvaz. What if the terrorists are not asking for money, which is not what they usually ask for? They usually ask for money in addition to freeing other terrorists from prison, right? They go for an exchange of captives. So again, what would you say here? So some would say that one for one is a fair swap. That's what the normal swapping in terms of kidnapping is, one for one. So if it's anything more than kidnapping, than swapping one hostage for one prisoner that you have, so this might be acceptable if we don't take into other things. If, for instance, if we say that the reason is impoverishment of the community, then certainly that wouldn't be a criterion when you're talking about exchanging captives. No one's going to get impoverished by exchanging captives. If you say that the prohibition is due to the idea of not encouraging this type of practice, then even if you are swapping captives, you still would have a limitation. The limitation would be, according to the Radvaz, more than what's normal, and that would probably be one for one. Anything more than one for one you cannot do. If they have 10 hostages, and they say, for these 10 hostages, we want you to release 10 prisoners, you might be allowed to do that. No. If we don't take anything else into account. If you say that, if they say, we've got 10 hostages, we want you to release 100 prisoners for the 10 hostages, then that would certainly be forbidden. Because here you're giving much more than what you could be termed the value of the hostages. It's not one for one.
There's also a cost of imprisonment, too. I think that would be calculated.
A financial cost.
Yeah.
In other words, because they also mention the impoverishment of society, so then if society is going to be impoverished by keeping the prisoners,
sure,
as opposed to releasing them, then yes, that would be taken into account. But because Maimonides and the Code of Jewish Law mention as the main reason for the prohibition being not to encourage this type of activity, then even if it is costing us money to keep them in prison, then we still should not accede to massive demands, because this would encourage this type of activity. That's the main reason we always have to bear in mind, according to Maimonides and according to the Code of Jewish Law. There was a famous sage in Europe, Rav Meir of Rottenburg. Rav Meir of Rottenburg lived in around, I think it was about the 11th century, Rottenburg in Germany. And as we know, Germany at the time was divided into more than 100 different little duchies. A lot of wars going on, etc. And the way in which the various dukes financed their wars was by taxing people heavily. And the Jews used to get hit very hard. However, the mayor of Rottenburg, very, very famous sage, he was one of the rabbis of the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher. And he was considered one of the greatest, if not the greatest rabbi in Europe at the time. Like probably the equivalent status, if there was one, the chief rabbi of Europe. So the Duke, I forgot the guy's name, whatever, this prince, decided to, he needed a lot of money, and decided to extort a ransom from the Jews. So he just imprisoned the mayor of Rottenburg. Took the chief rabbi, put him in prison. And he said, you guys want him back, you've got to pay an exorbitant fee. It was something in the hundreds of thousands of their currency, hundreds of thousands of marks, which would be equivalent nowadays in millions of them. So the Jews did not know what to do. Here their greatest rabbi, the spiritual leader, their halakhic authority, is in prison and is being demanded of them an exorbitant ransom. So what would they do? They have to ask the greatest halakhic authority of the time, Rav Meir of Rottenburg. So they send a delegation to the prison to ask Rav Meir of Rottenburg, should they redeem him? Classic halakhic situation. Here is a captive who is being asked for certainly more than the going price. There's, number one, a problem of precedent, creating a precedent, and there's also the problem of impoverishment of society. So they asked Rav Meir Rottenburg, who's sitting in town, this great rabbi, and he said, no, don't redeem me. It's forbidden. He says, explicit Mishnah. Definitely do not redeem me. So he lived in prison. We have, for instance, in the Rosh, we find very often, Rosh and Beitzer specifically mentions, that when we were visiting Rabbi Meir in the prison, he told us this and this. Students used to come to learn Torah from him in the prison. But here is this great rabbi, languishing in prison, and he refused, he told the Jewish communities of Germany and of Europe not to redeem him. And he lived, I don't know how long, he lived quite a few years in prison and died in prison. But before he died, he said to the Jewish community, don't redeem, and according to Jewish law, incidentally, Jewish thought, it is considered very, very serious not to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. Jew always tries to be buried in a Jewish cemetery with other Jews. It's very, very important, and have a proper Jewish burial. He commanded the Jews in Europe, in Germany specifically, not to even redeem his body afterwards. Let him be buried amongst the non-Jews and the prisoners in the prison cemetery, rather than they pay this exorbitant price even for his dead body. And for a while afterwards, they followed this. A rich Jew at the time, decided he couldn't take it anymore, this disgrace to the great rabbi, and he redeemed the body against this idea, and he was buried in a Jewish cemetery. But we see to the extent that this was taken very seriously. And had Rav Meir of Rottenburg, had the Jews given in, this would have created a terrible precedent. The anti-Semitism we suffered in Europe was bad enough. Imagine also having this idea that every time the non-Jews, every time the government needed some income, they'd just capture an important Jew, put him in prison, and say, okay, give us so-and-so amount of money. So Rav Meir of Rottenburg created a very important precedent based on this Mishnah, but he himself refused to allow himself to be ransomed by the Jews, even after his death, not to create such a precedent. So that's when it comes to financial matters.
I'm thinking not just in terms of monetary impoverishment, but also the leverage on the apparatus within the decision-making process.
He's saying that there's acceding to their demands, they're going to have an effect, aside from impoverishment of society, they can have a tremendous social impact on the society by capturing people, or by...
And manipulating the apparatus, the decision-making, the policy.
Exactly. Right. They're going to be able to manipulate the government. So we'll have to discuss that idea also. But there's another thing to be taken into account. There's another fact to be taken into account here. That is, that what about if they want to have a dangerous criminal released from prison? all very well if he says, listen, I want my brother released from Russia. That's fine, you know, they release his brother, who's a mild-mannered Boris. Right? But supposing the terrorist captures someone, captures hostages, and he says, in return for release of these hostages, I want my fellow freedom fighters, read terrorists in that, in place of that, and I want my fellow terrorists to be released from prison. So here, it becomes more complex. It's not just financial, it's not just impoverishment of society, and it's not just encouraging this type of activity. It's all those. You're encouraging this type of activity, you also might be impoverishing society if they ask for money also, but there's a third factor we have to take into account here. Exactly, endangering society. Because society is now putting itself in danger to save these hostages, because the terrorist gets out of prison. Is he going to be now redeemed? Is he going to be now repentant? I mean, I read recently that one of the major bomb manufacturers for the IRA, after a few years in prison, repented and decided to never, and went public in regret for everything he had done, and is now quite famous or infamous among some circles. But this is rare. Most terrorists, most criminals who go to prison are not reformed by the experience. Most of the Arabs who are put into prison in Israel, when they come out, they are again terrorists. They pursue acts of terrorism just the same, if not more, than when they were put into prison. In fact, there was a statistical study done, and the Israelis found that I think more than a third of the acts of terrorism were done by people who had once been in prison in Israel and who were let out for whatever reason. So you've got another factor here, which is, are we endangering society by letting out this person? And if we are endangering society, do you have an obligation, for instance, to save someone else's life by putting your own life in danger? So here we all, you know, there's a general rule, which is that if someone tells you to murder someone else, or they'll kill you, we say it's better to be killed than to murder someone. If the Chas v'Shalom situation where the anti-Semite tells Jew X to murder this other Jew or I'll murder you. So the Jew is not allowed to murder the second Jew. Because we say, who says that your blood is redder than his? Who says your blood is redder than his? Who says your life is worth more than his? You cannot make that judgment that your life is worth more than his. So in that situation, rather than commit the act of murder, the person has to die, has to be a martyr. But what about a situation, though, where the person is drowning, for instance? A person sees someone drowning. Do you have to jump in and save them at risk to your own life to save the other person? Because but the same logic that we used beforehand, who says that your blood's redder than his, we can use that in the reverse. Who says his blood is redder than yours? But if I have to put my life in danger to save his life, that means what in effect I'm saying is that his blood is redder than mine. In other words, his life is worth more than mine. So many authorities say that you're not obligated to do such a thing. You're not obligated to endanger your own life to save someone else's life. It is praiseworthy. It is praiseworthy and noteworthy. And it's a very pious act to put yourself into a doubtful danger to save someone else who's in immediate danger. You can swim fairly well. Now, it's conceivable there'd be a riptide and it could be carried out, but the other guy can't swim at all. He's in immediate danger. He's going to die for sure if you don't do anything. You're going to put yourself in... Maybe there's a bit of danger, but it's a doubt. It's an even doubt. So in such a situation, there are some authorities who say that you should, and most authorities say even though you don't have to, it's nevertheless, it's certainly praiseworthy to do so. The Beit Yosef says this. He says you're actually obligated to expose yourself to a possible danger in order to save a fellow Jew from definite danger. So according to this, maybe we should subject ourselves to, maybe society should subject itself to only a possible danger to help these captives get out of definite danger. The hostages are in definite danger. We're going to put ourselves into a danger which is indefinite, which is possible. And so maybe we should release terrorists in order to save these people. So Rav Yehuda Gershuni maintains He has an argument against this. One argument against this is that, first of all, this is not only the opinion, this is the Beit Yosef is not the only opinion. There are authorities who say that you're not obligated to put yourself even into doubtful danger to save someone else who's in definite danger. In addition, even the Beit Yosef agrees that if you are going to be in definite danger, you're not obligated to put yourself into a situation where you will be in definite danger to save someone else who's in definite danger. So it can be argued that releasing a terrorist is not called a possible danger. It's called a definite danger. A terrorist out loose is a definite danger. It's not just a possible danger. It's like a person already being... Society with terrorists on the loose is like a person who can't swim drowning. That's definite danger, right? It's not easy to place... to really... make a decision on this, and to call it, because it's never black and white, but it could be argued that the terrorist out loose in society is a definite danger, not just a doubtful danger. He brings, though, another argument. Rav Gershuni brings another argument as to why we should not release the terrorist, even if the hostage's life is in danger. That is, from a story in Tanakh, in Kings. Give you the exact quote. It appears, in the book of Judges 19. Book of Judges 19, we have the story of a man from the tribe of Judah who is accompanied by his wife, by his concubine, on a trip to a place called Gibeah in the land of the tribe of Benjamin. It's at the time of the Judges. There were no kings yet amongst the Jews. They were being ruled by judges. And there are no kings. Yeah, they were being ruled by judges. And this guy is going for a journey from the tribe of Judah to the tribe of Benjamin to a place called Gibeah with his concubine. What happens is that he wanders through the town. He cannot find a place to stay. No one's willing to offer him hospitality. Till one old man offers him hospitality. He says, "Come into my house. You can find refuge and hospitality in my house." So he goes into the house. And then the Torah relates that b'nei Belial, that people without a yoke, people without moral inhibitions, people lowlifes, right, members of a gang, whatever, lowlifes, gathered around this house and say, bring out the man that we may rape him. And the owner of the house refused to do this. Eventually, after a series of bargaining, they managed to get the woman. They managed to get his wife, or his concubine. And they abused her, they assaulted her during that night, dumped her on the doorstep the next morning, and she was dying from her injuries. And she told told her husband what had happened, and she died right there. So her husband buried her, but cut up one of her bones into 12 pieces and sent a piece of her body to each of the tribes of Israel and said, "Look, this is what happened amongst the Jewish people. How could such a thing happen amongst the Jewish people? How could you let this happen in the tribe of Benjamin, in the land of Israel, that the Jewish people should sink to such a level where this goes unpunished?" So the tribes of Israel got together and went to war and said, "We're going to assemble." They assembled an army, and they came and declared war on the tribe of Benjamin. And they said, "Give us these people who did this, so we can kill them, or we go to war against you." Now the tribe of Benjamin assembled an army, and said, "We deal with our own people as we want. We're not going to give them over to you. We'll bring them to justice ourselves. Sorry, we're going to assemble an army. You want to come and get them? You take them." So now you've got the tribes of Israel, the 11 tribes of Israel, assembling an army against the tribe of Benjamin, and the tribe of Benjamin with their army against the tribe of Israel. What happens is, the first time, they ask through prophecy. Prophecy tells them that the tribes of Israel will fail the first time. And they do. They go to battle anyway against Benjamin. Benjamin inflicts terrible casualties upon the rest of the tribes of Israel, and they win the first battle. In the second battle, the Jews go against... the tribes of Israel go to battle against the tribes of Benjamin, and this time And this time, they win. The second battle is won by the tribes of Israel. And they inflict terrible casualties on the tribe of Benjamin. And that's how the story ends. So now, what do we derive from this? Rabbi Yaakov Emden says that why were the Jews justified? It appears that both armies were justified. Because God let the tribe of Benjamin win the first time, and he let the Jews win the second time. So it appears that in essence, both tribes were justified in going to battle. How can this be? So what Yaakov Emden wants to explain is that the tribe of Benjamin were correct in going to battle because they were defending their right to judge their own people. They said, by giving over these people to courts of other tribes, this is the equivalent to anarchy. So we're going to go to battle against that. What the tribes of Israel, the other tribes of Israel, said was that not bringing these people to justice, that's equivalent to anarchy. So we are going to go to battle against you to bring these people to trial. So really they were both right and they were both wrong. The tribe of Benjamin was wrong in not bringing these people to trial. But they were right in defending themselves against giving them over to another tribe. The rest of the tribes of Israel were right in going to battle against the tribe of Benjamin to force them to bring the people to trial. But they were not right in saying, just give them to us. So what does Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yoshuni conclude from here? Because going to battle involves putting his life in danger and others' lives in danger, he says what we see from here is that in order to battle against lawlessness, against anarchy, against, as you said, outside control of your system, outside influence of your system, a system where justice breaks down, a person kidnaps someone and says, take the other guy out of prison. In order to battle against that, a person might be, in that such a case, a person's obligated to even put themselves in danger to fight against anarchy. Now, let's bring it back down to our system, our situation with the terrorists. When the terrorists capture someone, hijack a plane, and they say, release these people from prison, that is anarchy. It's anarchy. And acceding to their demands is acceding to the demands of anarchy. So you might say, yes, but why should... But if we release the terrorists, we're saving the hostages' lives. The answer is that even those hostages and all of society is obligated to put themselves into danger to fight against these terrorists. Which means one should not release the terrorists, even though the hostages' lives will be in danger. Even negotiation with the terrorists would be acceding to anarchy. So it's a very interesting idea here, because the terrorists are not just out to get their individual A, B, or C. It's not true. The terrorists, what they really want to do is destroy your society. The Baader-Meinhof, they want to destroy all capitalist society. Or the Red Brigades in Italy, they did not just want to get one of their members out of prison. Their object in general was to destroy all of capitalist society as it stood. The purpose of the PLO is not just to get the West Bank. The PLO Charter, as we pointed out, was written in 1964 when they had the West Bank. Right, it's to get the whole of Israel, to destroy Israel in total. Right? So the acceding to their demands is acceding to total anarchy, and hence every single Jew is obligated, right, even if their life is in danger, nevertheless to put one's life in danger in the fight against anarchy. So that those hostages now, even though they're in danger, it's a very tragic situation, but we would not be allowed halakhically to let terrorists out of prison for those three reasons. Number one, for two reasons. Number one, this is going to encourage further actions. So the Mishnah says that the enactment for the betterment of society, so you cannot accede to exorbitant demands by giving in, because this will just lead and encourage further actions like this. And second, this other idea, which is that we're fighting not just against this particular act of terrorism, we're fighting in a war against anarchy. And in the war against anarchy, what we see from Judges, from this incident in Judges, according to Rabbi Yaakov Emden's explanation, is that yes, one should put oneself in danger to fight against anarchy. What about a POW exchange of prisoners? Yes.
I was thinking in terms of an external release or a banishment from your society where you you know, you're still in control of the decision-making processes, and you're removing that element from your society. Rather,
you're
still an external endangerment, but it's more remote than to release them within your society. At large, obviously, you still have sovereignty over your territory.
Right. You're saying there's a difference between releasing them within the society and releasing them outside your society.
Right.
What Rav Gershuni wants to say is that even if you release them outside your society, the very fact that they are out free and at large is anarchy. It's acceding to anarchy. Even if you still retain control over your particular society, but what about society at large? What about them attacking you from outside? So not just the fact that they... you've also mentioned, true, that they've also manipulated you. That's anarchy, but aside from that, they are a danger to society in general. What Rav Gershuni also says is that a POW exchange is different from this. In a war situation, exchanging POWs would be different from this situation because, number one, it is first of all common practice to exchange POWs even if the numbers are not equal, so that you would not be going over the you'd not be going against the enactment of not paying more than their value, because it is common practice to exchange POWs. Secondly, there's no impoverishment of society here, because it's just going to cost you money to keep the POWs. Third, you're not going to encourage war in this way, because no one goes to war just because they're going to get a good value on their POW exchange. And there's no one who says, okay, let's have a war because I saw that last time I got 2,000 of my prisoners for only 10 of theirs. It's ludicrous. No one goes to war because they know they can get good value on the POW exchange. So you're not going to encourage this type of activity either. So in a standing army, the POW exchange is because it's, number one, common practice. And common practice includes even giving more, not exact parity of numbers, even giving more POW, even if the numbers are not equal. And it's also not going to increase the risk of war. So nevertheless, a POW exchange will be considered acceptable. But when we're dealing with terrorists, that is a different story. And hence would come what apparently from this Mishnah in Gittin 45a and from the stance of Rabbi Yehuda Gershuni would appear that the stance of the Israeli government is halachically correct, which is, as we said in the beginning, not to negotiate with terrorists, not to accede to their demands, because this will encourage further problems with the terrorists. It will encourage this type of activity, number one, and also number two, any release of terrorists in this type of situation will just subject our society and society in general to tremendous danger and will be succumbing to anarchy. Just one thing I forgot to mention, when we're talking about not putting yourself in definite danger to save someone else's life, one of the exceptions is, Eliezer Yehuda Voldenberg says, that an exception to that is in a battlefield situation, in war. In war, a soldier is obligated to put himself in danger to save his comrade's life. A Jewish soldier, to save another Jewish soldier, is obligated even to put himself in danger, even though in peacetime, a person would not be under such an obligation if there's definite danger to you. But in war, that would because this is how the fabric of the army holds together. It's an exceptional situation. Your obligations are much greater at a time of war. So in fact, we know in the Israeli army, people risk themselves to recover, not only to help a wounded soldier, but even to recover someone's body. In the Israeli army, Jews go into tremendous danger to save their fellow man. But this is an exception. Whereas in a battlefield, in a war situation, one is obligated even to go into danger to save your fellow man. Why? Because the very essence of war is going into danger. The very essence of war is putting yourself into danger. The whole situation is dangerous. So we can't apply the normal situation. We can't say it's like you're standing on the shore and the other guy's drowning. You're also in the water anyway. That's what we'd say in times of war. So it's very important to remember as an exception to that rule that I mentioned before. But yeah, also the point that you made about the prisoner of war exchanges, which is that it also tends to show the value we place upon a Jewish life. That we're willing to, when we talk about prisoner of war, 3,000 Arab prisoners for like five Israelis, five Jews in the Yom Kippur War, etc., is the type of thing that won't encourage the Arabs to go to war. The tremendous disparity in prisoners is an insult to them. So, but certainly exchanging prisoners is not the type of thing that will encourage them to go to war.